here with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Four people were shot in the opening weekend of deer hunting season. None of the shootings was fatal. And across Wisconsin, the DNR needs hunters to drop off deer samples at CWD stations to test for the lethal brain disease. What questions do you have for the DNR's chief warden? What do you think of the conditions where you hunt? Have you seen many deer? How do you stay safe when you hunt with kids? We're at 800-642-1234. Todd Schaller is chief conservation warden at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Todd, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Kate.
So what does the DNR know at this point about the injuries that you saw that occurred over the weekend?
As you indicated, we've had four injuries, and those occurred on Saturday and Sunday. All of them, relatively minor and non-fatal. Two of them were self-inflicted, so that's the firearm handler and the victim are the same person. The other two were two-party, same party. So that means there was a shooter and a victim. However, they were part of the same hunting group in one of those situations. In the other, they were not part of the same hunting group. So that's kind of the stats of those four incidents.
Is it pretty typical for people to get hurt during the gun season? Is what you're seeing a pretty typical weekend?
It is. On a 10-year average for opening weekend, we average about three hunting incidents. So we're kind of in that window. Lots of things impact the number of incidents. Obviously, our goal is zero, and that's why we continue to stress, as the season continues, the importance of hunters knowing and following our four rules of firearm safety and always having safety in the forefront of their mind.
So if a hunter falls out of a tree stand, for instance, and breaks their leg, does the DNR want to know about that kind of injury?
We're interested, although we don't count those as part of a hunting incident. And the same thing applies, occasionally folks overstress themselves and, suffer a heart attack or something, while out hunting. Our stats and data are based on, firearm or archery equipment incidents and not tree stand falls. We do stress tree stand safety as part of our deer season messaging and the importance of wearing harnesses and trying to reduce those, but we actually don't tally them or count them.
For the first time in a decade, hunters can shoot antlerless deer in every county due to the state's herd size. How many deer have been harvested so far?
At this point, we don't know for opening weekend. Actually, later this morning, we'll be releasing our preliminary harvest numbers for the opening weekend. And the reason for that is people have until 5 o'clock last night to register deer from the weekend. So we'll have a better sense. Obviously, our highest harvest numbers occur on, Saturday and Sunday, that opening weekend. And, conditions around the state were good. Deer numbers were good. Our hunting license sales were consistent with last year. So, I anticipate some good numbers.
So sales of licenses to hunt deer were about the same, slightly behind last year's pace. Can that be a big enough difference that hunters, might see fewer people in the woods, for instance, this year?
That does impact the hunt overall. If there's not people in the woods and there's not, people moving deer, sometimes the deer just lay down or stay in small areas and aren't as visible. I don't think the numbers that we're talking about are significant enough to have an impact to that. But, it's something we always watch. Wisconsin has a great hunting tradition, and we encourage people to, not only enjoy the sport themselves, but to maybe take somebody new and pass on that tradition and heritage.
We're talking about the gun deer season with the DNR's chief conservation warden, Todd Schaller, is with us. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Todd, based on the number of licenses sold per county, is there a part of the state that could be more fruitful for hunters to try out?
It's hard to say because our license sales are based on where the person lives. So we don't always know where they hunt. Dane County might sell 100,000 licenses, but, potentially 990,000 of them hunt outside of Dane County. So you know, there's a lot of part of the state, southern part of the state, that has some really good deer numbers, central and southern, and there's a lot of public land opportunity in those areas. So, you know, there is some areas where folks can, you know, get out and enjoy the sport, but probably have a higher level of success or likelihood of success.
And those CWD test stations, are those up and running in the places that you need them?
They are, and we really encourage hunters to help us track and engage the CWD, spread of CWD in Wisconsin. We have kiosks in all the areas where we want sampling. So if hunters are hunting in a CWD impacted area, we really encourage them to participate in sampling. It helps us manage our deer herd into the future. The other thing along with that is this year we have adopted dumpsters. So it really provides a convenient opportunity for hunters who are successful to properly dispose of their carcasses after butchering. So if they butcher at home, they can, every county has an adopted dumpster, and it's an easy way to get rid of it, get it out of your household, and then we'll properly dispose of it.
Do you find, and this is that adopt-a-dumpster kind of first year, do you anticipate a lot of people will be using those?
I do. Actually, this past weekend, I was in the central part of the state. We drove by a couple head collection kiosks, so we just checked to see how that was going, and all of them had you know, samples submitted. There was a dumpster nearby. I looked in there just to kind of monitor it, and yeah, I think it's catching on. I think people appreciate that convenience and easy way to dispose of a carcass and submit a sample.
Todd, did the state's early winter weather change the conditions for hunters this past weekend?
You know, it's hard to say. I think it changed the dynamic of the fall, and so I think it could have had an impact. Also, keep in mind that the deer season, the start of the deer season this year, is a little later than normal. You know, it's always the Thanksgiving weekend, and just how things fell, it's later than later in the year. So that can have an impact on deer and deer movement. Lots of factors impact the deer season: weather, time of year, number of hunters, so amount of crops that are still on the field. So lots of things impact it. But we do have a great tradition and a great opportunity in Wisconsin.
And things are going to be pretty wet for much of the state later this week. And, you know, that could also change hunting conditions.
Absolutely. You know, sounds like central southern Wisconsin is going to get some rain, so that's going to probably impact folks. Northern Wisconsin, potentially significant amount of snowfall, and, you know, that may impact that. It may prevent people from getting back up to their deer hunting camps for the final weekend. So, yeah, there's a lot of moving parts.
I imagine this is a pretty busy time for you. Can you ever make time to go out for yourself and do some hunting?
It's an extremely busy time for a lot of people at the department. And most of us, you know, we find an opportunity to get out and enjoy the sport that we get to work around. So, yeah, we all do. So.
Well, Todd, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Todd Schaller is Chief Conservation Warden at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Gun deer harvest season wraps up Sunday, and the muzzleloader hunt starts Monday. Coming up, we look at work being done to stop HIV from spreading, and a Wisconsin organization that is taking its model into Colorado and Missouri. What questions do you have about HIV and AIDS? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at efforts to stop the spread of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Ken. Thanks for being here. To date, the FDA has approved dozens of antiretrovirals and treatment meds for HIV and AIDS. The good news is that this provides a number of options for prevention and management for people at risk and for people living with HIV. But nationally, more than 38,000 new infections are reported each year, according to the most recent government data. Are you or someone you know living with HIV? How do you support them? Do you take an HIV prevention regimen? How seamless is it to get your meds? We're at 800-642-1234. Mike Gifford is CEO of Vivant Health. Its former name is the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, which has been working in prevention and treatment in Wisconsin for 20 years, and he joins us from our studios in Milwaukee. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin is changing its name to Vivant Health, and you mentioned in this announcement about outdated service models and geographic base names. What do you mean by that?
That's a great question. You know, the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin has developed this nationally renowned model of care known as an HIV medical home. It's the only HIV medical home in the country that's been recognized by the federal government. And with that, we're integrating health and social services in a way that's creating great clinical outcomes for our patients and clients. The outcome for us as an organization is more than 27 states have turned to us now for help and assistance in expanding and improving their fight against HIV. And that's led us to expand our services into Colorado and Missouri. So as you can only imagine, when I'm meeting with the mayor of St. Louis and explain that I'm with the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, it becomes sort of a head scratcher. And we've decided to evolve our name into a more powerful national brand to represent what we do in the fight against HIV.
And when you take this HIV medical home to other locations, other states even, how do you replicate what you have going on here in Wisconsin?
We always look for a great local partner that's already in the market that we're moving into. So in Denver, it was a group called Rocky Mountain Cares. In St. Louis, it's a group called St. Louis Effort for AIDS. They'll also become Vivant Health moving forward. And then what we do is build upon the services that they currently offer by opening up medical clinics and pharmacies, dental clinics, or other services that they don't provide to people with HIV and AIDS, knowing that that holistic comprehensive integrated care model is the key to people with HIV living a long and healthy life.
And when you say the holistic approach here, you are merging both the physical and the mental to really meet someone where they're at with their care. What are some things we might not realize that go into caring for someone who has HIV?
Yeah, it's the merging of the physical and the mental health, and then also helping overcome what's known as social determinants of health. So on the mental health, on the physical health side, I think we all sort of understand that, right? People have a virus. They need to be on medications. They need to have lab tests and those sorts of things to monitor how the disease is progressing or not progressing within their bodies. We know on the mental health side that as many as 60% of people with HIV and AIDS struggle with a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue sometime during the course of their disease. And we're making sure that we're providing those services in really innovative, cutting-edge sorts of ways. And then the social determinants of health is what I think really makes us unique as a healthcare provider anywhere in America, where we're really going after some of those root causes that keep people out of care or prevent them from taking their medicines on a regular basis.
What might be some of those root causes that really hinder the ability to get their medications, to get the care they need?
Yeah, for people with HIV, certainly one of the social determinants of health is poverty, but it goes beyond that. Poverty and prejudice, isolation, different illnesses that they may have, hunger and homelessness, all sort of wrapped together. It's really some of the worst of what society has to offer is really fueling the HIV epidemic right now. So to overcome those sorts of things, in addition to the mental health and drug treatment services that we offer, we've got one of the largest food pantries in Wisconsin with 10 locations around the state. We provide millions of dollars in housing assistance. And we do that because we know that somebody who is hungry is going to be more focused on seeking out food to put in their stomachs than the medications that keep them alive, or somebody that's homeless is going to be more focused on seeking out shelter than a doctor's appointment that can help them live a long and healthy life. So getting some of those basic needs met so people with HIV can really address their health care is one of our goals.
We're talking with Mike Gifford, CEO of Vivant Health. You can join in. What questions do you have about the spread of HIV? Are you familiar with the work of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin? Did you ever visit the Center for Resources? Do you think that we're in sight of a cure? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike, last month, the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, declared that New York is on track to meet its goal to end the AIDS epidemic in that state by 2020. New York is where the first cases of AIDS were reported back in 1981. What is the current state of HIV prevention and care in our state here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know, I certainly want to applaud Governor Cuomo for his efforts to end HIV in New York by 2020. You know, they had over 2,500 new HIV infections last year. So to get from 2,500 to zero in New York would be literally unheard of. So it's more of an aspirational goal right now, and it's consistent with, although the timing varies, the aspirational goal that the president put out in his State of the Union address back in February. You know, here in Wisconsin, we certainly have seen a decrease in new HIV infections since its height in the early 90s, and there's several hundred new HIV infections a year here in Wisconsin. Unfortunately, in Wisconsin and around the country, that number has really plateaued in recent years, and we need to break through that that plateau with greater access to services, and certainly the biomedical prevention work that is available now, greater marketing campaigns, trying to reach those individuals at greatest risk to contract HIV, getting them the information materials necessary to protect themselves and their loved ones.
Why do certain parts of the country face more challenge with preventing the spread of HIV? Because shouldn't we be going at this all together as a whole nation here?
Certainly, we need to be looking at this as a national epidemic, and far too often our federal policy has not done that. They have focused on different communities or hotspots for new HIV infections. It's oftentimes described as public health whack-a-mole. Maybe we'll intervene here and do well in one community at the same time that we see the epidemic spreading and intensifying in another area. You know, and a lot of this comes down to society's acceptance of people who are at risk for HIV, which really does vary around the country, and then even more so public policy on how to fight HIV and AIDS. Things like states that expand Medicaid have typically done better in making sure people with HIV have access to the medications that live a long and healthy to live a long and healthy life. States that support things like clean needle exchange have been shown to see a reduction in new HIV infections, including here in Wisconsin, where we've done needle exchange for more than a quarter of a century now, and what we've seen is about a 75% reduction in new HIV infections. So it's a combination of those public attitudes about HIV and people who are at risk for HIV, along with the public policies that either can support or really inhibit a strong response to HIV.
What has the policy been toward using a pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP drugs that could drastically reduce the risk of contracting HIV through unprotected sex? Where are we with PrEP drugs?
You know, PrEP is one of the most exciting developments in the last several decades in the fight against HIV. It's essentially taking the HIV medication that you would give to somebody who's HIV positive and instead providing it to somebody who's HIV negative. And it's been demonstrated that along with the use of condoms, it can prevent new HIV infections at a rate that exceeds 90%. And I'm really pleased here in Wisconsin that we're able to assure unfettered access to PrEP, certainly through public policy like the Medicaid program that covers PrEP, but then also through things that Vivant Health is doing in terms of providing free access to the medication, free access to doctors' visits, free access to laboratory testing. Unfortunately, what we have nationally is that only about 90% of people with people at risk for HIV really have access to the medication, and it gets far worse for populations that have higher rates of HIV. So only 97 to 99% of people of color aren't able to access PrEP, even though we know that that's where a majority of new HIV infections are happening. Part of that is cost. Part of that is access to healthcare providers who are comfortable and confident in prescribing the medication. So while we've got this powerful tool, which really is the fast track or the fast lane to getting to the end of the AIDS epidemic, far too many people who can benefit from PrEP are actually able to access it.
We're talking about efforts to stop the spread of HIV transmission as Wisconsin has seen the number and rate of new HIV diagnoses decline over the past decade. Mike Gifford is CEO of Vivant Health, which was formerly the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Are you familiar with the work of this organization? Did you ever visit the Center for Resources? Are you familiar with PrEP? Do you take an HIV prevention medication? Join in your questions, your situation, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Mike Gifford right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about HIV prevention that will require multiple kinds of interventions. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And as of right now, there's no licensed vaccine to prevent HIV, and developing a viable one has been a challenge. We're looking at the public health component, the research, the policy, and the work of resource centers, all the efforts to eliminate HIV transmission in our country over the next decade. Your questions, your stories are welcome. Are you someone or someone you know living with HIV? What is your quality of life like? Are you in a relationship with someone living with HIV? How do you take care of each other? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Gifford is president of Vivant Health, and he stays with us. Mike, looking at the opioid epidemic, wondering what an impact that is making on furthering the spread of HIV.
That's a great question. You know, the opioid epidemic is consuming our country in a way that very few would have ever thought. And we've seen terrible outcomes of that as it relates to HIV and AIDS. I think back to Scott County, Indiana, a couple of years ago. This is a rural county in southwest Indiana that had maybe a few thousand residents, and several hundred of them contracted HIV over the course of about a six-month time period. So it has an opportunity to be an accelerant. The opioid epidemic has the opportunity to be a really significant accelerant when it comes to HIV and AIDS. And here in Wisconsin, we've seen an uptick in new HIV infections, small as it may be. The most recent state report on new HIV infections noted that the opioid epidemic is starting to have an impact on increasing HIV cases related to injection drug use here in Wisconsin. So at Vivant Health, we're working to really address both of those epidemics with HIV prevention and opioid prevention efforts that really come hand in hand to try to meet the needs of people who are struggling with injection drug use.
So it's the needle sharing that is the big issue there?
Certainly the needle sharing is a prominent issue there, and that's where our Clean Needle Exchange program actually needs to be expanded to reach more people who are in the throes of addiction. We also are pleased to distribute Narcan, the medicine that helps reverse overdose death, and distribute tens of thousands of vials of that on an annual basis to save people's lives from an opioid overdose. And then also are really pleased to be one of the drug treatment providers that really help people move into a period of reducing, eliminating drug use, and ultimately moving into an era of sobriety in their lives.
Let's look for a moment at the treatment options out there. Truvada was being used for HIV treatment, and they wanted to see if it could work for HIV prevention. And this particular drug company that makes it was willing to donate enough doses for the trial. How important are these medical drug trials right now for trying to find a cure?
Certainly, the ongoing research in HIV medications is vitally important. You know, we are almost four decades into the epidemic at this point. More than 70 million people worldwide have been infected with HIV. And while we've made great progress on HIV care and treatment and even beginning to provide the biomedical interventions to prevent HIV in the first place, the progress on the cure has unfortunately lagged significantly. You know, the world's greatest scientists have been focused on this for decades now and are not making the progress that is getting us towards a cure. And that's why it's so important to continue to invest in this, because we know without a cure, the opportunity to end the AIDS epidemic is many, many more times difficult.
What holds the scientists back? And then what about a new strain of HIV?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that holds the science back is how resilient the virus is and how frequently the virus will mutate. I was in Washington, D.C. with some researchers last week, and they talked frequently about how this virus mutation issue, how it responds to treatment, is a real inhibitor to finding a cure. And we just did find a new strain of HIV. It's the first time in quite a while that a new strain of HIV has been identified. This instance, Tony Fauci, who's the head of really the national response to HIV, a scientist and researcher who's been focused on this throughout his entire career and throughout the entire HIV epidemic, Dr. Fauci's come in and said that this is a relatively minor strain. I think he described it as an outlier. But it does show that there are a lot of things about the epidemic and about the virus that we still don't know almost 40 years into the fight against HIV. And that's why we need to reinvest more time and effort and candidly financial resources so we can get to that day where there's an effective vaccine or a cure for HIV.
We're talking with Mike Gifford, president of Vivant Health, and you can join in. What questions do you have about the spread of HIV? Do you take an HIV prevention medication? How has it been going for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mike, we heard from Justin in Appleton who called in but couldn't stay with us. And Justin wants to know if HIV can spread from mosquitoes if someone who is positive has been stung.
You know, it's really important for us to understand what are the risks associated with contracting HIV, and I really appreciate Justin's question. It's important to keep in mind that HIV can be transmitted through unprotected sexual contact, through the sharing of needles. That contributes to the vast majority, 99% of HIV infections in this country. And then it can be transmitted from mother to child, although we've done a remarkably good job eliminating that here in America, a mother passing on to their newborn baby. So things like sharing a glass of water, eating with the same utensils, the mosquito sting or bite scenario that Justin offers up are things, Kate, that people do not need to worry about as it relates to contracting HIV.
What about outreach efforts? Does your organization face challenges in trying to get people in, to get patients in, to get the word out about resources and what is available?
Certainly, there's a lot of challenges in our society around educating people as it relates to HIV and AIDS. You know, one of the challenges that we at Vivant face often is that society doesn't always support individuals who are at risk for HIV, members of the LGBT community, or people who inject drugs. But even beyond that, there are really basic things that we could do to increase people's knowledge about HIV and AIDS. My wife and I are blessed with three teenage daughters, and as any good parent does, we keep up on their studies and looked at their health textbooks recently, and I was really disappointed at the limited amount of information and the drastically outdated information that they were receiving about HIV and AIDS in the school systems. And with more than 400 school districts around the state of Wisconsin, each one of them individually deciding what they're going to teach around HIV and AIDS, that becomes very, very difficult to try and get the word out, accurate information out about the disease and about resources that are available. And if we as a society aren't going to educate our young people about HIV and AIDS, we shouldn't then be surprised that they're at risk for HIV and AIDS, because they're coming from a point of just really not being aware of it and not knowing what the risks are of HIV.
And oftentimes then your resources are at more of the tail end as people are coming in with, being affected by HIV or really not knowing what their future will look like.
Not knowing what their future looks like, not knowing how HIV can affect them, or candidly learning of their HIV positive status when they come in and do a test at Vivint Health. So we do need to move this upstream. We do need to have schools and families and other sources of HIV information provided earlier to people, especially young people in our society.
Last month, California passed a bill which would make that the first state in the country to allow pharmacists to dispense PrEP and then also PEP drugs that can prevent new HIV infections. What does that influence look like in not having a prescription?
Yeah, that is really a very exciting development, and I want to applaud Governor Newsom and the legislature in California to understand the importance of this. It goes back to what we were talking about, Kate, earlier in the interview. PrEP, the opportunity to take those HIV medications when you're HIV negative to prevent you from contracting HIV in the first place, really powerful opportunity, but we know 90% of people who could benefit from PrEP aren't on it. So this is a really innovative way to reduce barriers to PrEP. You don't have to go to the physician. You can just go right to your pharmacy and get the medications. Still need to make sure that you're seeing a lab, doing the right testing to make sure that the medication is still appropriate for you. But it follows along what we're doing at Vivint Health in terms of creative and innovative ways to provide care to people with HIV. In this case, really increasing the pharmacist's role in healthcare. And unfortunately, our healthcare system really oftentimes puts a pharmacist in a box and really reduces in a secluded way, prevents them from doing really good care. And I'm pleased at Vivint Health that we've got pharmacists who are fully engaged in care for people with HIV.
Talking with Vivint Health CEO Mike Gifford, our guide, as we look at efforts to stop the spread of HIV. Are you familiar with PrEP? Do you take an HIV prevention medication? How are you doing? Be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Mike Gifford in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 7,000 people known to be living with HIV lived in Wisconsin at the end of last year. An estimated 1,300 additional people may be living with HIV in our state but are unaware of their diagnosis. That's from the latest annual report, HIV in Wisconsin, from the Department of Health Services. We're looking at what the future holds for HIV prevention and care with your questions, your stories, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Gifford stays with us. He's CEO of Vivint Health, which serves more than 7,000 patients a year. Mike, we've been talking about PrEP drugs and then also PEP. What is the difference between PrEP and PEP?
Great question. You know, it just has to do with the moment in time when people are at risk for HIV. So PrEP is designed to be something that you would take on a long-term basis prior to any instance where you may be at risk for HIV, an unprotected sexual contact, as an example, almost like the birth control pill. And then PEP would be something that you would take after right away, after a short window, right away after instance where you may have put yourself at risk of contracting HIV. So PrEP is a long-term medication. PEP is usually prescribed for about 28 days post potential infection to reduce the chance that you can contract HIV in the first place.
What have you seen as far as known side effects in these drugs?
You know, one of the real nice advancements about HIV medications is that the side effects have gone down dramatically, and they're typically very minor. So you can think back a couple of decades when the antiretroviral therapies first came out, and there was tremendous side effects of fatigue and nausea, almost debilitating side effects, candidly. I remember having conversations with patients at the time where they were really struggling with, is it better to deal with the side effects or not take the medications in the first place? Mm. A lot of that is thankfully in the annals of history in terms of the fight against HIV. Very few side effects. The medications are well tolerated. And, you know, they're really easy to take. You know, for PrEP, we're down to one medication once a day compared to the cocktail medications of a couple decades ago where people were literally taking handfuls of medication throughout the day.
Let's bring in a call now. Gia is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Gia.
Hello. Hi, Mike. I used to work for you at ARCW.
Wonderful to hear from you again, Gia.
Thanks. Speaking of outreach, we were discussing, I used to run education groups for different, like, outpatient treatment centers, group homes, things like that, where we would just do a very brief, I still know mine by heart, very brief, you know, education presentation tailored to the group that we were with. So some of the high-risk populations, IV drug users and street workers, would know. And so they would know. We would get invited to Milwaukee Public Schools events, but we were not allowed to say, like, talk about condoms at the time. That's what they were, you know. So it's kind of like, so what? I understand why they would want us there, but we weren't able to give anything, any effective advice. Mm. So that was very, very frustrating. But we did do at least intervention on with vans throughout the city. So we did counseling and testing from the vans.
And Gia, how important was this type of educational outreach and getting into the community, getting in the van, and really going to neighborhoods?
I personally have, you know, I have a lot of stories, but we do have, needle exchange is statistically the most effective public health intervention in America ever. And I saw that over and over and over when, you know, different populations would come to the truck or to the van. And then we would, we had incentives that we would have for people to take the test. And that was just for anybody.
Gia, thanks for the call. And we're short on time here. Mike, what about these vans that you go and offer services and education?
You know, that's just our commitment to making sure that people with HIV and those at risk, that we're overcoming all the barriers to getting them the services they need. So rather than them coming into us, into a clinic, us going out into the community in minivans that look just like what any of us parked next to in the parking garage this morning, is a big part of our intervention. But I want to pick up on something else Gia said. Trying to do an HIV prevention education campaign without saying condoms is similar to a driving instructor teaching somebody how to drive without being able to say the words seatbelt. right? It's really ridiculous, and it's rooted in ignorance, and it's rooted in stigma and those sorts of things, and really speaks to what we were talking about earlier in the call about the need to provide, you know, really unfettered information, unfiltered information. You know, we can't put these political constructs or what society wants to deem as politically correct or safe language around this. We have to be very bold and very straightforward in educating people about HIV, like what Gia tried to do for years for us.
Let's bring in Seth now in Rockford. Hi, Seth.
Hello.
Yeah, what's go ahead.
I just curious about thoughts as to there's kind of a subset of people within the gay community, men, that participate in parties with alcohol and drugs and unprotected sex. And I know quite a few people over the last couple of years that have acquired HIV infection because of those activities.
Yeah, Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, certainly those are the activities that fuel the HIV epidemic, whether it's drug use or unprotected sex. But we also have to keep in mind that it's just not gay men who are engaging in parties where there's drinking and drug use happening. That is a challenge that society faces on its whole, and provides us a great opportunity to educate folks, make sure that there's those prevention materials available and information available so people can protect themselves. The gains that we have made in the fight against HIV, the reduction in new HIV infections, the longer life that people with HIV live, including here in Wisconsin, people living with HIV longer than anywhere else in America, they're all at risk if we don't keep up a really strong, robust, vibrant response to HIV. And that's really the goal of Vivant Health as we move forward.
So December 1 is World AIDS Day. This is the international day dedicated to raising awareness of the AIDS epidemic. What do you see on this day as you look from where we've come since 1981 and the first cases to where we are going in the future?
Well, certainly it's a moment in time for us all to remember the millions that we've lost from HIV and AIDS. And I do really hope that folks take a moment and reflect on and celebrate the lives of the millions of people that we've lost to HIV and AIDS, but also use it as an opportunity to redouble their efforts. As I was saying, the progress that we've made in the fight against HIV is really precarious at this point. We know that new HIV infections have plateaued in some instances. They're actually ticking upwards. We know that people with HIV and AIDS need unfettered access to health care at the same time that the federal government is looking at cutting $1.5 trillion out of the Medicaid program, where we haven't expanded Medicaid here in Wisconsin. Those are really significant barriers that could set us back in the fight against HIV. So as we commemorate World AIDS Day on December 1st, this coming Sunday, I hope folks that will redouble their efforts to help us get to our vision of a world without AIDS at Vivant Health.
Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Mike Gifford is CEO of Vivant Health, which provides HIV care and prevention at a dozen locations in Wisconsin, Colorado, and Missouri. He joined us from our studios in Milwaukee. Just ahead, we'll talk about how to show off your culinary skills on Thanksgiving with a few life hacks from the deputy editor of Taste of Home magazine. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.